Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Bookroom Studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necron on the Pod with your hosts, Mike Snuffler, Mike Moncada, episode 131, The Amulet by Michael McDowell. The story of a woman in her quest for haunted accessories at the softer side of Sears and the women who love them. And now, Necron on the Pod.
Military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Comrade Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, we are here for the very first of our Michael McDowell episodes. I'm kind of excited.
I keep forgetting I'm not in love anymore.
You're going to do that. Every episode, aren't you? That's
until I think of another one of Michael McDowell's. That's great. Songs.
So we started with this Michael McDowell book, his first horror novel. But I was reading up about him a little bit, and this wasn't meant to be a novel.
I think it was supposed to be a script for a show of some sort.
Yeah, it was a screenplay that he was shopping around and nobody bought, and so he simply expanded it and turned it into a novel, and that he sold.
I'm surprised it hasn't been turned into a movie of some sort.
Well, it's kind of curious because one of the things that this book reminds me of is just sort of the catalog killings of your standard Friday the 13th movie. Or a Final Destination movie.
Yeah, it reminded me of Final Destination. Yeah. There must be a long history of haunted jewelry, cursed jewelry.
I think so. I think Bram Stoker had one. Wasn't his one about Egypt and the mummy? Wasn't that about haunted jewelry?
And I don't know. Wasn't there one called The Moonstone or something?
Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, right?
And
I never read that, I'm ashamed to admit.
There's got
to
be a lot of cursed jewelry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this one is about an amulet, not a necklace.
Yeah, what is the difference between an amulet and
a
necklace?
I think amulet is just
to ward something off. Or
yeah, I think the amulet is supposed to be something more than a necklace.
A neculus.
Neculus.
I don't know if an amulet has to necessarily be worn around the neck.
Yeah.
But it is usually
like a brooch.
It could be a brooch or a tennis bracelet. I think
it's, like a gecko pin.
It could be a gecko pin. A cocopelli pin. I think amulets are normally jewelry, and they're normally used to ward things off.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I don't think of them as usually something to make something bad happen, but who knows? It is in this book.
This is something that we'd have to ask that extravagantly mustached guy on Antiques Roadshow. He was set us straight. How much do you think is worth?
So is this the first one of his books you've ever read?
Very first. This is the very first book by him I've ever read.
So what was your first... Well, should we do a little short kind of synopsis of what the book is about?
Yeah. I mean, there's not much to it, really.
Not much to it. Simple plot.
A newly married man is hurt in a firing range accident before he's sent off to Vietnam. It's like 1965.
Yep.
And he gets sent back home to his wife, who is 20, and she is living with his mother, who is a very unpleasant woman.
Very unpleasant.
Josephine. And he's... incapacitated. He has bandages across his face. He is non-responsive, but he is not dead. We don't know what he's thinking, or we never find
out. He's living, but he's not alive.
Yeah, he's
we really don't know.
Persistent vegetative state.
But he's able to eat. So
yeah, he's able to eat. And for some reason, his mother, and possibly with his sort of mystical cooperation,
possibly
decides to get vengeance on the people who put him there, and his vengeance is, and her vengeance is wide-ranging and unfocused.
And it's just basically the town.
The town. So the whole town is basically dependent on the munitions factory nearby, which produced the gun that blew up in his face that took off his eye.
And his brain.
And his brain, part of his brain.
And his mouth.
And his mouth. And and the way that they get this revenge is the mom has this amulet that she gives to his friend who comes to visit him, who works at the munitions factory. And whoever wears this amulet, the same thing happens over and over and over again. So this is, so at this point, we're on like page 50 of the book. The next two sentences will cover the next 300 pages.
Yeah. They kill somebody and then they die themselves.
And then they die in an accident. Yeah. Yeah. And each one of these scenarios is increasingly baroque. So it starts with like a house fire. Not too well, crazy.
It's pretty gruesome.
Yeah. So
the mother drugs.
So hold on there. Okay. Because we are often asked to read a passage.
Inferior.
This is the passage.
We are not your slaves.
This is the passage I would like to read. Why don't you vamp while I try to find it? See, I should have.
What else can I say about amulets? I remember the first time I ever heard of an amulet was in Dark Shadows. Angelique had an amulet. And I think she gave it to Barnabas Collins, which caused him to become a vampire. So now I think it is a cursed object. I also remember in The Mummy there was some kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Not in the original Mummy, but in one of those Mummy movies there was an amulet. They don't bode well.
They do not bode well.
No.
So here's a little passage from chapter 12 of the book, wherein it is written, and I quote, Rachel Coppedge sat on the edge of the bed in an attitude that was completely relaxed. She was bouncing her youngest child up and down on her knee, smiling at it, plying it with a soft voice to stop its crying. The baby wailed abysmally from the discomfort of the heat and the smoke. At this point, the house is actually on fire. Larry's voice crested a moment over the buzzing, undefinable noise that the house makes when it is on fire, calling Rachel's name and those of their children, but Rachel did not respond. She looked up briefly when their seven-year-old daughter, Beverly, ran past the bedroom door screaming. The child's pajamas, of a synthetic material, had melted onto her skin, and her curly blonde hair had been completely singed away. Beverly's four-year-old sister lay dead of smoke inhalation in the hallway. The two boys were beating against their locked bedroom door, screaming in fright that was even greater than their intense abdominal pain, but the noise gradually subsided beneath the crying roar of the flame. Larry lay on the floor of the guest room, unable to raise himself for the intestinal cramps. He would have gladly given over the struggle if he had not been able to hear the frantic cries of his two boys in the next room. He wept for his helplessness to preserve their lives. The fourth wall of Rachel's bedroom caught fire, and a ceiling beam collapsed into the middle of the room, ignited the bedclothes and the contents of the cedar chest. The infant on Rachel's knee fainted, overcome by the smoke. Rachel lifted it to her breast, cradling its head against her shoulder as if it were asleep, and walked it across the room, carefully avoiding the little patches of fire on the carpet, as if they had been toys left by the other children. She laid the child in the burning wicker bassinet, tucked it lovingly between smoldering sheets. She turned around then with a small smile and picked up a fragment of the full-length mirror that had exploded a little time before. Holding it before her, she admired in it the handsome, becoming, stylish amulet that Larry had bought her that afternoon. Again, Larry called her name, but his voice was very weak. "What do you want, honey?" she called back, still looking at the piece of glass. "I'm in the bedroom." That was chilling.
Yeah, it's still chilling.
Absolutely chilling.
Yeah.
And in some ways, because that was like the first one. It just, because it's so flatly written,
right?
And charmingly written. It was tucking this child into flaming sheets.
Yeah, that's the image that stuck with me.
Well, and the child with her hair burned away and her pajamas melting onto her skin.
Mm-hmm.
That was grim.
That was really grim. And then the one where the hairdresser is.
Oh,
dissolving the woman's hair and then just peeling the scalp off her.
Yes.
Head and putting it onto a wig.
Well, and frame. The toddler in the washing machine.
Oh yeah, that was
very unpleasant. I'm surprised.
Again, the dead babies.
I was gonna say, how upset did that make you? This is your axe to grind.
It is. It's You know, it didn't bother me.
Yes, isn't it?
I don't know why. I mean, it didn't strike me until you just talked to me right now about it.
Interesting.
It was, I don't know why.
There's something
because a lot of people were dying. It wasn't just babies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was whoever.
Yeah, I mean, another child gets scalded to death by melting sugar. Melting candy.
Yes.
So
and adults died too.
Yeah, lots of. I mean, I remember all the kids, but I remember pretty much every death. And there's a lot. There's a lot, and they're all very fanciful. There's one involving a hay baler. There's one involving
the one where the woman grabs the steering wheel. They go into the creek. She gets out. She picks up a tree limb and starts beating her husband over the head. Yep. And then she goes up the embankment and gets hit by a truck.
Gets hit by a truck.
Classic.
Classic. That was so one of the things about that kind of catalog of murders, every 35, 40 pages or so, there's another murder suicide or murder death by misadventure struck me as very thin. But
what do you mean?
Well, it's just like a murder of the week sort of. It's like we're gonna just tick these all off, one after another. It's a very unsophisticated way to plot a story.
Hmm.
It's just one after another. This amulet just keeps moving from possessor to possessor, and the same thing keeps happening over and over again every damn time. That said, it didn't bother me because it was so cartoonish.
Yeah, it was cartoonish and gruesome and awful
all
at the same time. But yeah, I mean, at some point it had to end because something had to keep moving forward or it's just going to get boring.
Yeah.
Which was teetering on boring, but it never quite
got there. Mostly because, for me, the characterization of all these people that you get to meet and then watch die is actually pretty great.
Yeah, you do Everybody feel like you get to know. Yeah, you do feel like you get to know them in like in a thumbnail sketch.
Yeah, they're these great little character sketches.
And it's mostly just wondering, well, how's it going to happen this time?
I know.
Now what's that crazy amulet going to do?
Yeah,
and then just pick on something that like a little kernel that's inside a person.
Yeah,
that it expands it like a blowing up a piece of popcorn.
Exactly.
From the kernel.
Yeah. Yeah, it amplifies whatever's mean and small and unforgiving in them, and it becomes murderous. And it takes like 20 minutes.
Yeah, the minute they put it on. The only person that didn't happen to was the woman who got eaten by pigs, and it was the pig who killed her,
and then died by and then, was slaughtered.
Right. So brought out.
Yep.
The pig wasn't wearing a necklace.
I know.
It had swallowed it.
Yep, and it mostly happens to women, but it does happen to one man.
Yeah, it does happen to a man.
And that's kind of it. And then the only time it changes is in the last pages of the book, when our main character Sarah, the injured man's wife, finally has had enough, and she is going to.
She figures it out pretty. Yeah. Early that this amulet has done this, and her mother-in-law's has set this in motion
and is not, you never find out if the mother-in-law is approving of all the mayhem that's happening, or if she's sometimes surprised by who's dying, if she actually has any control over where the amulet's going.
I don't feel like she had control over where the amulet's going. I feel like she didn't enjoy that it was happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't matter. She was an awful.
Yeah.
She reminded me of a wicked version of the woman and the mother in Gilbert Grape.
Me too. Yeah. That's what they describe her. Yeah.
That's how I kept thinking about her.
Yeah. She's well north of 300 pounds. Yeah. She's
lazy.
Lazy and just mean.
Blamey and mean.
Yeah.
And,
in the last scenes, So throughout the book, Sarah, who has seen that this amulet has been involved and is starting to put these things together, tries to find this thing. She's chasing all over town trying to find it, gets the cops involved eventually. And in the big climactic scene, she works at the factory, and so she's at this factory.
Yeah, the factory. That was crazy.
And, you know, the factory becomes like Carrie's prom. The whole thing just starts falling apart. Just all the machines start going crazy, and
people are dying left and right, and things are exploding.
They're getting chewed up by machines, but she gets back home, and she is there, and she has mixed some lye into the applesauce that she's feeding her husband, and he starts to die as his tongue and esophagus starts to dissolve. And the hateful mother-in-law says, "You must have the amulet, aunt." And she says, but she does not. So Sarah is killing out of her own pure will.
And who can blame her?
And who can blame her? Exactly. And
did
at the upshot is
lying the mother-in-law's applesauce too. I don't remember. I don't know. The mother-in-law was talking.
Yeah, she was talking. So I think she had plans to. You know, she was about to kill her.
The last line was like she just had this little smile.
She had this little smile
because she said she destroyed the amulet.
Yeah, she had melted it in the forge at the gun factory, which may have something to do with why the whole factory is going nuts. Who knows?
Well, I don't think she did that until the end. It was going nuts, and then she finds it.
Okay, yeah. So this, I mean, it's not all sewn up very neatly either. There's some mystery preserved in this book, which when you start reading it, so this is, I have this great, I'll try to put this cover of the version that I have, which is the first edition. It's pure 80s, super ridiculous horror novel cover.
Yeah,
it's this big chain with a big amulet in the corner, and it's twisted around all these southern types, people who, you know, there's a guy in overalls and a woman wearing a gingham dress, and they're all, you know, in dire straits being choked by this chain. This scene never happens in the book, by the way.
No, the amulet's not that big.
No, nearly, but so one of the reasons I'm glad we read this book is because that this book is one of those throwaway 80s thrillers.
Yeah.
70s, 80s horror, like spinner rack thrillers.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to make you ponder life's
no
big questions or...
No.
But it was a good romp.
It was a
and
good
it was easy to read, thank God.
I know.
And it was simple. He didn't throw everything.
I know. But still, you like got a sense of the characters. You cared about them. They weren't so... None of them were especially wooden.
No, they weren't.
You know, which is the case a lot of times. You know, you have the square-jawed hero, you know, holding, you know, protecting the woman in the flowing gown from the ancient evil. Using his knowledge and his pectorals. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case here. The heroes in this story is a young woman.
And her best friend next door.
And
also goes bad.
Yeah, and their success is marginal at best.
Right, which felt very 80s horror. Yeah. Like there's no victory.
No really. Victory. So I haven't read this yet, but I found online an interview with Michael McDowell from the 80s. So we'll have that read by the time. But I did see a little, like a pull quote. You know, there was a question like I think the interviewer was asking him, you said somewhere that it's your duty to kill your favorite characters. And I don't know where his answers was.
R.R. Martin got George R.R. Martin got
very likely. I wonder if they knew each other because George R.R. Martin was writing horror at this time too.
Huh.
The book Fever Dream came out right around this time.
Oh yeah, Fever Dream.
Yeah. I remember that. So,
and then Michael McDowell says.
Oh well, I don't. I did, I, that was just a pull quote. That was all I read. I was like, you know, you said this somewhere, and I was like, so I'm waiting to see how he elaborates on that.
No, I did never said that.
I never said that. What kind of a monster do you think I am?
Put on this amulet. I bought you this necklace. I bought you from the Avon collection
from Montgomery Ward. Anyway, so one of the things I've learned about Michael McDowell is that he is prized for his writing of Southern Gothic horror. And we'll probably get into this more as we read some of his other books. What did you think of this as Southern? When somebody says Southern Gothic horror, what do you think of? I mean, what other books would be in that genre?
It's funny what I think about is To Kill a Mockingbird.
I do too. I seriously do. That's Southern Gothic, but it's not a Southern Gothic.
It's not horror, right? Flannery O'Connor, Graham Greene.
Yep, I think of those. I think of William Faulkner's more dark stories, like A Rose for Emily.
Shirley Jackson.
Shirley Jackson, for sure.
This didn't feel like Southern Gothic to me, and I don't know why. It didn't. To me, Gothic is a little bit more brooding and
I could see
a little bit more languid.
Yeah, and
this wasn't that. This moved in a clip.
Yeah.
And
it didn't reach back. Well, it doesn't reach back into the dark, sinful past that Southern culture has to deal with.
Yeah, it really didn't.
It deals with it a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Yeah,
It's more of a backdrop than center stage, where I usually think in Southern Gothic that the Southern sensibility is right in the forefront of things. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel that here. This could have happened in any town is what it felt like to me.
Yeah, kind of.
It could have been a Stephen King.
Yeah.
It could have happened in New England.
In as much as a Gothic, I don't have a definition of what the Gothic is or the Southern Gothic is, but in my head, one of the elements seems to be that it reaches back towards some original sin in the past, some dark, half-remembered past. So with Southern Gothic, often that has to do with the legacy of slavery or the legacy of plantation wealth and worker poverty.
Well, there's some of that's in here.
Yeah, and there is some of that in here.
There's the other side of the tracks, and there's a point where she wants to go to the funeral to investigate, but it's at the black side of town, and they can't. Mm-hmm. They're like, wouldn't.
Yeah, they could go to the churches, but they can't go to the
funeral home. Yeah. And I mean, so that stuff does.
Yeah, and they touch on some of that stuff a little bit. You know, they do talk about race in here a little bit, and about the relation, what the black side of town can do, where they can go, and same thing with the white, and both have limitations. Obviously, the black side of town has more limitations, and they talk about apparently the events of this story happen just about within a year after the Selma March, because it's mentioned.
There's all these pieces there, and you've got kind of the old. The congressman who's wealthy, who kind of owns the factory, and there's all that. It's all sort of, it's mentioned,
mm-hmm.
but it's not
explored.
It's not explored or integral to what really is happening.
Yeah, I think it's kind of assumed that you are plugged into how the genre works a little bit. And I guess maybe I am.
I guess I just felt like it didn't matter.
Yeah. Probably,
you know, it wasn't. See, I guess in Southern Gothic, I also think the town is a character, and mm-hmm. I didn't feel like the town was a character in this. I felt like the town was there and it was a backdrop, but it wasn't the character so much.
Yeah, except insofar as Josephine and Dean, the mother-in-law and the invalid husband, wants to kill the town. They blame the town.
Right, but I don't know how else to put it. I think, to me, in Southern Gothic, you get the sense of the heat
mm-hmm.
and the humidity mm-hmm. and the kudzu hanging on things. Kudzu
or sphagnum moss.
Or the barking dogs that have rabies. Or the
sagging porches.
Yeah, that you get. It's more, in my mind, it's sort of like what happens in those Japanese anime movies where they'll just pause on rain going to a bucket for
you know, for
5 seconds.
Or show cottonwood fluff going around.
Right.
Floating in a forest.
And so that the place becomes a character. And maybe it is a character, but it kind of didn't matter if it was in the South.
Yeah.
Is what I felt like.
Okay. I can get that. Another thing that it kind of reminds me of is, I guess it's a novel, and I think people call it a novel, but it's really a collection of short stories called Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwin Anderson.
Mm. Sherwin Williams, the paint person?
Sherwin Anderson. And all it is this portrait of this small town told in these little short vignettes. And some of the characters walk in each other's characters' stories, but they're always, all the little vignettes are separate stories all by themselves. And this book actually kind of works that way. As the amulet moves through the town, you get to hear these little stories that all end the same way.
It's very cinematic because it's sort of like it pulls out and then you're kind of, you can almost see the camera pulling out, moving through the town and then landing like on the beauty shop, and the scene happens there.
The scene happens there.
That pulls out and then it moves into the mortuary.
Yeah.
Whatever. You can kind of almost see that happening.
Or do you remember Richard Linklater's first movie called
Kids Say the Darndest Things?
No. That's Arthur Linklater.
Is it Arthur Linklater?
No. Richard Linklater, who his big breakout movie was Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
But before that, he did a movie in which the camera just went from character to character in Austin, his hometown. And you would just be with these characters for a little while, and then the camera would literally lose interest in that person, and someone else would walk by, and would follow somebody else.
Yeah.
And then you'd get that person's story.
Yeah. I never saw it, but...
Yeah, I mean...
It's been done.
It's an interesting way to do a... I think somebody did something... like that with like a gun traveling through like the underworld. It was like a famous noir movie that just shows the story of this gun moving from person to person.
Yeah, okay.
And in this case, it's an amulet.
First thing people say is it made of gold?
And you never know.
You
never find
out. They say it every time. Mm-hmm. Is it made of gold?
Exactly. So, what else? I mean,
that's all I got.
There's not a lot to talk about yet. I think as we get deeper into Mr. McDowell's oeuvre, we'll have more to say. But
He'll be a little bit more. He'll be a little bit more practiced and a little bit more seasoned. In the next book.
Another thing,
Elemental's got a great.
Yeah, Elemental's is supposed
We don't even know we're reading that yet. No.
We have no idea what we're reading yet because we have to go in the basement. We can't even think about it until we're in the basement. And we can't go to the basement until what?
It's cocktail time!
All right, here we are.
Well, you surprised me with this little ditty that we're drinking, so... All right, I have no idea what's in it.
All right, I'm just going to tell you the name and I'm going to give you the recipe. This is called Southern Discomfort. And see what I did there?
I did. You're very clever.
All right, so get yourself a rocks glass and throw some ice in it. And then in a shaker, throw some more ice. And then in the shaker, put about 2 shots of fresh grapefruit juice. And then 2 shots of Southern Comfort. Maybe a half shot of simple syrup, and then get yourself a jalapeno pepper. Take one little slice of it, rub that around the rim of the glass with the ice, and throw it in. And then shake up the rest of it in the shaker and strain it into the rocks glass with the ice, and enjoy.
My reflux thanks you.
Southern Discomfort, ladies and gentlemen.
There we go. Chin chin.
My lips are burning. All right.
That's not all that's going to be burning.
No.
Let's go cool off down in the basement.
Let's do that.
And we're in the basement.
Here we are. All right.
Reading Elementals.
We're going to read the Elementals.
Let's leave the basement. Was it his second book?
Third, I think.
His third book.
Well, actually, it's a good question. So he wrote the spate of horror novels in the 70s and 80s, and then finally did get some purchase on screenwriting, and was the screenwriter for the movie Beetlejuice and for the movie The Nightmare Before Christmas. But he also wrote other novels under pseudonyms. And this one series of novels, he got three of them out there called, what are they called? Jack and Susan? The Jack and Susan novels, I want to say.
What's that about?
And each one of them, it's about this couple who sort of live well and have a dog and solve crimes, kind of like the Thin Man movies. But they're ageless. And so he was going to write one of these novels with this couple set in every decade of the 20th century. But he only got to three. He wrote 1953,
1933,
and
1913. Oh, okay. Sounds interesting.
It does sound interesting.
Those are the kinds of things I would read.
Yeah, well, exactly. It says they're not horror. And he wrote other stuff, too. He did some novelizations for movies and things like that. And
But Elementals is its own thing. It's not a novelization. It's
his own thing, okay. Just like The Amulet. Yeah, so we're going to do The Elementals.
Well, here we go. Let's get out of here. And we're out of the basement.
And thank God.
I know I left my drink up on top.
I'm not looking forward to choosing the third book because I want to suggest that we read the really big one.
Blackwater. It's more than one book.
I know it's six
4,000 books.
It's 800 pages, and when it's in one volume, it would be a multi-month read.
Okay. Anyway, it is the summer.
we'll table that and right. We'll come back to it after we're done with the Elementals.
Yeah. Well, anything else about this book, The Amulet?
Well, this book came just at the right time. I was kind of wearing out on these heavy, hard to read, overly complicated horror novels. This was not that.
And it was really refreshing after
absolutely delightful.
After our last three books.
I know.
I tore through that baby like it was.
The last three books and the three books before that, because didn't we do before that Cormac McCarthy?
Yes. Yeah. Those were also
heavy. Also Southern Gothic.
Yes. In a way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Totally. For sure. The first book.
The first one was, yeah.
For sure.
Mm. So, yeah, I'm very excited to be reading Michael McDowell. And it puts me in mind of there's other writers from this era that don't get props as much as they should.
Well, that's our book group.
That's what we do. So
rescue the forgotten.
Yeah. So we'll snoop around. Maybe we'll pull up another one soon.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, anything else?
Not really. I did go see the movie Hereditary.
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna go see it.
No, it's not that scary.
Oh, I heard the images get into sink in you and then disturb you for a long time.
They do not.
Oh.
They most certainly do not. There's one. I mean, you like, well, you're a big fan of children dying, right? Yeah. You're going to love this movie.
It's too easy to kill a child. It's too easy.
But the movie was very good. At the end of it, I saw it with a group of people, and at the end of it, we, had to go someplace and get a drink and debrief. And we talked about it for a good long while because it at the very end, you finally get the last pieces so you can understand what the fuck is going on in the very first scenes and all through the middle of the movie. So it would bear rewatching so you can put it all together.
Okay.
Properly. And I think I will do that. I think I'll probably stream it when it comes available for streaming.
Maybe that's when I'll watch it.
Yeah.
Well, there, I got nothing.
You got nothing.
No.
All right. Well.
All right. What should we do with this sucker?
Well, I think we should take it out to the
Let's take it to K Jewelers.
Because they buy gold. And
we'll just leave it. Let it pick out something nice, and then we'll just it out of the car on the way home.
That sounds great. All right, bye. Bye.
forgetting we're not in love anymore. I keep forgetting things will never be the same again. I keep forgetting how you made that so clear. I keep forgetting it all. Every time you're near, every time I see your smile, hear your hello, saying you can only stay a while. Hey, I know that it's hard for you to say the things we both know are true. Tell me how come I keep forgetting we're not in love anymore. Things will never be the same again. I keep forgetting how you made that so clear. I keep forgetting, baby, every time I hear how you never wanna live a lie, how it's gone too far. You don't have to tell. The game is through. If this is real and if this is true, tell me how come I keep forgetting we're not in love anymore. I keep forgetting things will never be the same again. I keep forgetting how you made that so clear. I keep forgetting. Don't say that, don't say that. I know you're not mine anymore. Anyway or anytime. Tell me how come I keep forgetting.